97.9 FM, WCHL, and chapelboro.com present The Art of Potential, an illuminating talk show dedicated to getting your community educated, hired, and inspired. The Art of Potential combines real-world knowledge and expertise aimed at helping our community reach their full potential. Now, The Art of Potential on 97.9 FM, WCHL.
Hi, this is Kristen Heemstra. Welcome to The Art of Potential show. I have one of my favorite guests. I have Debbie Steer here. Welcome, Debbie.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Okay, so you may, if you've heard the show before, have heard Debbie talking about her quest to make the perfect score on the SAT. So how did that end up working out for you?
Well, it worked out amazingly well, but not the way that I had expected it to. I guess in some ways, my son improved his score 540 points from his PSAT. Yeah.
What?
I never calculated
that's
that.
Insane.
Because there were so many other fringe benefits that seemed so much better than that. You know, start with the fact that he loved it and that we bonded. I mean, and I did not have a Striver kid. I had, you know, Huck Finn as a kid, and he loved the SAT, which was, you know, that exceeded my expectations alone. The fact that he got a great score, you know, that was, weirdly enough, you know, I never actually calculated that out until at the end of the book, my editor said to me, well, how much did your son gain? And I was like, you know, I never calculated that. And I went back, and it was 540 points, and I improved 310 points. So, you know, we did improve a lot. However, you know, I would say the best part of it was, you know, the connection that I established with my son. And, you know, we got very close during the process. So
I'm sure. So for those of you who haven't heard our previous interviews, Debbie decided for some wild reason that she, being the mother of a, he was a junior when you started this, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think when I came up with the idea, it was the summer going into his junior year, and I was trying to get him to study for the SAT at that point. He had, you know, B's, he was taking non-honors classes, he had very little in the way of extracurriculars, and we were, you know, facing junior year, and I was thinking, how the heck am I going to get this kid into college? And by the way, pay for college.
Right.
And so I was trying to get him to study for the SAT, and he was so far from thinking that that was, you know, he thought he would do it a few months before he took it. Yeah.
Right.
And so in order to interest him, I said, you know, what if I took the SAT? And it started out as kind of a joke, and then I kept layering ideas onto it. And I'm going to take it every time it's offered. I'm going to, you know, take it at different locations. And I kept upping the ante on myself and to try and engage him. And it worked. It did work.
So one of my favorite stories is about you all having dinner time conversations around SAT words.
Yeah. And now I'm doing that with my daughter, actually. It breaks my heart that I keep hearing that they're going to take the vocabulary off of the SAT because, you know, vocabulary is the spice of life. Why on earth would they do that? Not to mention, great literature is filled with interesting vocabulary. And a lot of the books that the kids are reading in schools these days, while they might be good books, they're not, you know, laden with the kind of vocabulary that Shakespeare used, that, you know, that's in great literature that kids are going to read presumably when they get to college. So my son was resistant to learning the vocab until he saw his first college and then really wanted to get in and started studying the vocab in earnest. I should say, actually, it was the last college we saw on the college tour. And we just had a lot of fun with it. You know, we would use it on, you know, at dinner. He would use it in his papers. We would nudge each other during TV shows and movies if we saw it, you know, in the newspaper or in a book. And vocab is fun. I really feel very strongly they should not futz with that on the SAT.
Which is interesting to your point. I'm not sure why they would, because I mean, if you think of words are kind of like energy. It's how you communicate your feelings and, you know, and so a lack of words means a lack of ability to communicate ideas and nuances and things of that. So
exactly. That's right. And, you know, if you open up great literature, you know, they use, you know, in 1984, that book is filled with, quote unquote, SAT words, which, by the way, are just words, but, right. you know, it's sophisticated vocabulary, and why on earth would we not want our children to know that?
That is interesting. So you haven't seen any research that says why they would discontinue it?
Well, I haven't. I just keep hearing talk of it, and I keep sort of hoping that I'm misunderstanding or he's being misquoted, right. Because I really think it would be a crying shame to, you know, to dilute the vocabulary.
Yep.
And
yep.
to make it more pedestrian, to use an SAT word.
Yeah.
I want my kids to be able to read Homer and, you know, great literature. Why not?
Yeah. One of the spices of life. I like how you said that.
Yeah.
So you were saying that you and your son went on college tours. How?
Yes.
Okay. So advice for parents who are in the situation right now. What is your take on that?
Well, I heard what most people probably hear is, you know, if you pass a college before junior year, stop in and see it. But really, save it for junior. You don't want them to feel pressured. That seemed to be what everyone thought, that the college tour was pressure. You don't want to do it too early. And we did the college tours junior year. We took two of them and actually won the first one school the beginning of senior year. But we did one February break of junior year and one April break of junior year. And what I found was that they were the most motivating variable of all, because we would go to these schools and then you know, we would run back to the hotel room to see what his chances were. I mean, I'd sort of looked beforehand, but,
right.
you know, some of his favorite schools, he was right on the line of getting in or not. And by spring of junior year, the cake is kind of baked. There's not that much that you can do to make a difference.
Right.
Versus if you're doing it earlier, you can still, you know, make adjustments. So if I had it to do over again, I would have started probably sophomore year. You know, maybe even freshman year, that's probably too early, but, you know, why not have that goal in mind? And with my daughter, who is now a junior, we just took visited our third college, and next week we have two more, and I already see that, you know, she saw school the other day, and she said, that's where I want to go, and it's a very difficult school to get into. Well, she's very driven and very patent, so now she's looking into exactly what they need. She's got two full years to be able to make any adjustments that need to be made so she can get into that school, if, you know, to give it her best shot.
Your advice is so on target. I just think it's so important that parents hear you, if you're a grandparent, to hear this too, because one of the things, to your point, that motivates a student is their ability to see themselves on the campus.
Yep.
And that's what happens on a tour. They walk around and they say, oh my gosh, these people are like me, or these are cool people. I would like to hang out with them. Or the opposite is true.
The opposite is true as well.
Right.
I mean, we went to one college, and she was sure that's where she wanted to go, and we walked out, and she said, I didn't like it at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I agreed with her, and I'm so glad that we visited that. And the variables to get in, you know, vary greatly. So that school, it was a very specific thing that she, a direction she would have had to go, and the school we saw yesterday, very different things.
Mm-hmm.
So she can direct herself. And as I said, we're going to go see more schools next week, and we're going to take a trip in a month. And why not have that vision now? And she can start working backwards. This is what the school requires. Let me see if I can do my best and get in there.
Such great advice, because working from the perspective I do, where I work with high school students, and I've done this for, you know, well over a decade now, it totally changes the student when they identify where they want to go. And the other thing that will do that is if they've identified a career path they want to be on.
Exactly.
But when they see that, like the geometry homework that they didn't want to do, they suddenly find the motivation to get through doing
it. Exactly. That's exactly right.
The other thing that will make a difference is if they get in a relationship with somebody who has really good grades. We do see
that. Is so funny that you say that, because I told my son when he went to college, I said, find really smart girls and hang out with them a lot.
Yes. No, that's very true. And it's funny, because I gave the exact same piece of advice today to a student, because one of the things when you are evaluating college you want to look at is their graduation rate.
Mm-hmm.
It's so important to pay attention to, and a lot of people don't. They just look at the information. All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking more about the SAT and about this amazing book that Debbie has written. So you are listening to the Art of Potential show. We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Art of Potential on 97.9 FM, WCHL.
Welcome back. This is Kristen Heemstra with The Art of Potential show. We are having a fascinating conversation with Debbie Steer. And Debbie, okay, so you have written a book about your experiences doing the SAT. Can you please enlighten us about this? I love this.
Okay, so it's about my experience and about my experience with my son. I took the SAT 7 times the year before he did. And I attempted to study, 12 different methods. I probably did less than that because there really aren't that many effective methods. The bottom line at the end, I think, is that if you have a solid foundation, test prep is enormously effective or can be enormously effective. And if you don't have a solid foundation, there's no amount of test prep in the world that's going to get you a significantly higher score. It's going to be, a few points here, a few points there. I think that was the moral of the story based on my scores. And I got, a perfect writing score, and I got a 99th percentile on the reading. And I spent, 20 plus years in book publishing. And I got basically the same score I got in high school for the math, a little bit more, although they recentered it, so maybe it's the same score if you recenter my 2011 score.
Right.
But, the bottom line is I didn't have a strong foundation in math, and I spent the whole year studying for the math, and I love the math section, but I don't think they pull that 10,000 hours for mastery out of nowhere, and I had nowhere near mastery. What I had was vague recollection, and you have to think very quickly on the SAT. You have to know something like a ladybug has spots. You can't sit there. There's no time. I think you get a minute and 20 seconds per question and go, wait, what is that again? Is zero an integer? I can't remember. Is positive? There is no time for that. It has to be out of the working memory and into the long-term memory so that you can use your working memory to work on the puzzles, because that's really what it is. I mean, the easy problems are pretty straight, and as they get more difficult, they play with what you know to see how well you know it. And I had a very shaky grasp of math, and I hadn't done math in many years. So you place many years on a shaky foundation and spend a whole year studying, and you get what I got, which is almost no score gain versus the reading and the writing. I was very, I wouldn't say easily, but it came much more easily, improvement.
That is so interesting. So obviously with your experience, and it sounds like just in your high school and stuff anyway, you had a broader interest and a stronger foundation in the reading and writing.
It was just my natural propensity.
Yeah.
Probably
yep.
Math was a little bit harder for me,
yeah.
Although the funny thing is I still maintain that I'm good at math. I remember distinctly when I got turned off for math, it was geometry. I had straight A's until then, and in geometry, I found it hard. I didn't maybe connect with the teacher or have a good teacher, and I kind of gave up at that point.
Well, they also had us doing proofs back in the day. They don't even do those anymore. They decided,
right.
That turns a lot of people off, and you don't use them in real life a
right.
lot of the time.
Right. So for whatever reason, I quit math, and I sort of took on, in our culture, it's sort of acceptable to go, I'm not good at math,
right.
and I took that on, especially for girls.
Right.
And so I took that on, and that's, I don't think it was ever true, and I don't think it's true really for anyone. Certainly some people probably have to work a little harder at it than others, but
yeah.
I think anybody who practices hard, especially from the time they're young, is good at math. And I think, had I had that from the beginning, there are cultures where they don't even know that saying. It wouldn't occur to them. And where
right.
math scores are not lower for women,
right.
for girls, where they don't have that saying, the scores.
It's almost an entitlement. So
yeah,
it's like,
we're okay with that in America.
Yeah, I'm entitled not to be good at math.
Exactly. Versus in other cultures, that would mean I didn't study hard enough
right.
in math. So.
And they would blame you for your own, shortcoming
right.
in that particular area. Very interesting. Okay, so you did 11 different, roughly 11 different test prep methods.
Mm-hmm.
So of those, let's break those down. Obviously, you did Princeton and Kaplan and
Well, I didn't, you know, I sort of lumped all commercial test prep together because I did do Kaplan for a month. Mm-hmm. And then when I went to go choose, and it was not a good experience, my score actually, well, I had sort of an 11th hour brain scrubbing before the test because I took a practice SAT right before I was going to take my test right after Kaplan, and I saw that I'd gone down. Like, where were all the tricks that I was taught in my Kaplan books? They weren't in the real SAT, and the advice that they gave me wasn't working. So, for instance, they say go by ear for the writing section. They also say the writing section was not in order of difficulty. Well, both of those things are, well, the writing section is in order of difficulty, except for the improving paragraphs at the very end of it. So that was a false piece of information. And then the other thing was that the go by ear is a terrible piece of advice because that'll get you about, you know, a 650 if you have a great year. At the end of the hard questions in the writing section, they purposely make them sound right and are wrong, or vice versa. They sound wrong and they're right. I always say, is it wrong or is it, you know, does it sound wrong or is it wrong? You actually have to know the grammar to get higher than, say, a 650.
So you can be reading a sentence thinking, oh, that makes perfect sense. You know, that's how somebody was.
Right. I've heard people say it like that before.
Right.
Or they actually do the opposite more frequently now that I'm thinking about it. They make it sound wrong and it's grammatically correct.
Okay.
That's really what they do. Yeah. In the harder questions, when you get to, it is an order of difficulty, but in the fixing sentences, you know, around, say, question 10, 11, they start to do that. It sounds wrong, but it very well could be right, and you have to know what grammar to check. So your ear isn't going to help you there.
Right, right.
And so I sort of lumped all. After that, I was very gun-shy about the commercial test prep, and I did look into, well, I had stacks and stacks of books, right. And I saw all the advice was conflicting. One book would say, always start with option E and go from there. And another book would say, always start with option C and go from there. And the truth is, neither pieces are great advice. And there's a little bit of truth for some kinds of problems for the option C thing. But there's, you know, option E is completely arbitrary. I lost my confidence in the commercial test prep. And after that, I went back to the original piece of advice that I got. The first piece of SAT advice was always use official material, College Board material. Mm-hmm. And I went back to that. And so everything I did after that was based on official test prep
college
material. That's not to say there weren't exercises to help me bolster certain areas. And there is some great non-official test prep material, but it's rare. And I would say one of the signs of is it good or is it bad, yeah, and this would apply to a tutor, a test prep class, a book you're looking at, anything having to do with the SAT, if they're leading you back to the College Board, to the official material to help you decipher it, that's a sign that it's good.
Okay.
And if they're not, if they're trying to get you to take their practice test and use all of their materials and buy more of their books, if they're not using official material and not leading you back to official material, that is a big red flag.
Well, that's an easy way to decipher then. You can you can say, okay, they're just trying to make more money. That's what it sounds like.
And they do, you know, they also, and there was absolutely nothing scientific about what I'm going to say, but they have that branded advice because they're trying to sell you more of it. You know, the such and such method, I'm making this up, the Gruber method, the Kaplan method, the Princeton Review, however they say it. They all had sort of branded advice, and so you're supposed to read all of their books. So I got nervous that no one was leading me back to a real SAT. And after I saw what had happened, you know, I realized that the person who gave me that piece of advice, by the way, you know, I'd graduated from MIT and got top SAT scores, and I realized how right he was. And then when I started looking at the other books, a lot of them were self-published by great tutors. There's Erica Meltzer's books on the reading and the writing that are extraordinary, and she leads you right back to the blue book. In fact, after she gives you lots of exercises, she tells you, she's got an index that will show you in the blue book which questions are like the one she's describing in her book. And then there's Pone the SAT for the math, and he has an essay guide. And again, he has a whole chart in the back that leads you back. If you want to see this question type, go to you know, these problems in the Blue Book, which is the College Board's book, Philip Keller's book, same thing. So I did notice that seemed to be a common denominator of the good ones. They were leading you back to the Blue Book and helping you decipher it.
So your advice would be just out of the gate, get the Blue Book and start with that.
Absolutely. Though I would say this, there are 11 tests in the Blue Book. So if you really are going to practice a lot, which I personally think you should,
right.
11 tests might not be enough for you. And so you're going to want, I think there's 23 official tests available. So there's 11 in the Blue Book, and then there's one free one on the College Board site, and then there's, you know, 10 or 11 in the online course. The online course costs about $75, I think. Something like that.
It's wow, that's very expensive. Reasonable.
Very reasonable. And there's more to it than just what I said, than just these practice tests, but the real value is in those practice tests. Anyway, so yes, I would get the Blue Book, but I would be very mindful about saving enough full, real practices that you have not touched to use to take full-timed practice tests, because the SAT is every bit as much about, you know, endurance and performance under stress as it is about the knowledge. So, you know, it's a 4+ hour mental marathon. You have to know, and you have to build that muscle. It really is like training a marathon. Mm-hmm. You need to endurance train. So you're going to want to save some of those tests to take, you know, and in one sitting, 4+ hours, and then spend a week or two correcting your mistakes and knowing them so well that you can explain them to your teacher. So don't just willy-nilly go cherry-pick your way through the Blue Book, because I actually did that. Then you spoil the test. You know, then you've ruined it. If you've done all the ones you know, that test is sullied.
Yeah.
And, you know, I hopscotched my way through, you know, a Blue Book, and before I realized, oh, you need to save some of those tests for, you know, a full-time test.
Great advice. Yeah.
By the time I got to my son, I mean, he did like 10 full-time tests, because I realized, and some of the kids, I mean, at these top tutoring places, they have them do, you know, what they say, 10 to 15 full-timed proctored practices before they get to one real SAT. And one of the tutors there told me, he goes, I really have my kids do 20 full-time proctored tests before a one
Holy
real
cow.
SAT. Yeah, because
wow.
It is. And my son saw the value in that right away. It does, once you start doing it, you get used to concentrating for that long. I was not used to concentrating
right.
in a land of Twitter, you know, and
right.
everything is, you're not focused on one thing for that long. It's very hard. You have to build that.
Well, great advice. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I still want to hear all about your book. I want to talk about your book. So you're listening to The Art of Potential Show with Kristen Heemstra. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to The Art of Potential on 97.9 FM, WCHL.
Welcome back. This is Kristen Heemstra with The Art of Potential Show. I am talking with Debbie Sear. So, Debbie, you wrote this amazing book about you and your son's journey with the SAT. So what's the name of the book?
The book is called The Perfect Score Project, Uncovering the Secrets of the SAT, and it is not on sale yet. It will be on sale February 25th, 2014, so you can pre-order it now, and you can have me come speak, you know, in
awesome.
Your neck of the woods if you want that.
I think it would be amazing. So let's talk about how, now children, so I work with teenagers, they mm-hmm. typically do not wake up and say, oh my gosh, I can't wait to go take the SAT. Like, I've never heard that come from a teenager's mouth.
Right. And I did manage to do that with my son and now with my daughter. I wouldn't go so far as to say I can't wait to do it, but both of them will readily admit to me that it is fun, and I can feel that they like it. And I do not have, you know, the stressed out, neurotic overachievers that you read about at all. And my kids were, you know, the middle of the bell curve. They were having a good time, and they were not thinking about, you know, the fact that their college slot was being competed for internationally. They were thinking about where's the party on Friday night. And so, you know, and they were happy getting B's, okay? Maybe not my daughter as much, but my son. So how on earth was I going to convince convince him that this SAT really actually was important and he had to study for it and care about it, you know, when he was a sophomore, which really is when he should have been studying for it. And that is how I came up with the idea of, you know, doing it myself with him. And looking back, and it didn't take long for him, I mean, it took a long time for him to admit to me that he liked it, but I could feel that he liked it. First of all, I'm going to say this. They all balk. Right. Everyone hated the SAT from the get-go. You're supposed to hate
the
SAT.
Yeah, you're supposed to. That's like a culture.
And it's just another culturally accepted notion that we all hate the SAT.
And we're going to complain about it as much as we can.
That's right. And I sort of said to him, you know, we'll put that aside. I don't really care whether we love it or we hate it. You have to do it, so let's just try and have fun with it. And it really did not take long before I could feel that he was enjoying spending time with me doing it. Again, it took a while for him to
admit that. Are you sure you weren't the magic sauce and not the exam?
No, I absolutely am the magic sauce. No, okay. But any parent with their child, you don't have to take the test seven times like I did. That's been great. And I don't even know what, you know, I have no idea
how
much
relief.
Energy you have to put. But I am absolutely certain that any level of warm engagement with your kid over the SAT or anything else for that matter, especially when they're teenagers and they're so hard to connect with, but this, you know, rite of passage that they have to go through, I am absolutely certain that any level of warm engagement makes it a positive experience. And my daughter was much more difficult than my son. I mean, he was, you know, somewhat compliant, if, you know, not necessarily at the time driven. Though, by the way, this experience turned him into a much more driven kid because he saw what he could do.
So he experienced success, which then builds self-confidence.
Exactly. And I kept it, you know, I made these pretty charts and graphs that as he was taking the practice test, he could see his improvement, which at the level he was at, it was, you know, one or, you know, two more questions, right? But the graph was going in the right direction.
Yes.
And that was motivating.
500 points worth of questions,
yeah.
Right?
Yes. Yep. With my daughter, it was more of a challenge because she's an artist. She's, you know, she wants to be an actress. And this was so far from anything she thought she would be interested in. She was so predisposed to despise it. And she came around quickly. And I heard her saying, you know, she admitted it very quickly. And she enjoys it. And she, again, it goes back to the warm engagement with your kid over it. And we sit down and do it together. She said, Mom, I'm going to do a section without you. And I said, no, I want to be there with you because I actually really do. But it is a shared experience. And I do think that is the secret sauce making this test not as miserable as it can be. And again, you don't have to do it seven tests like I did. Any level of warm engagement. There's a big difference between putting pressure on your kid, you know, you have to do this, da-da-da-da, with like a, you know, from above, versus sidling in next to and, you know, having a shared experience.
Okay, so warm engagement, mm-hmm. as you're defining it, is you and your child sitting down with a practice SAT exercise,
mm-hmm.
with a timed thing going.
You can do it timed or not timed. I mean, I would suggest the more you can sort of get into it and experience what they're experiencing, the better. Mm-hmm. You know, we sit down at the kitchen table and do it together, timed. And, you know, and with the math, actually, both of my children are better at the math, which they find, you know, enormously entertaining.
I was going to say, I bet there are some, like, you have to open yourself up if you're going to go down this path, because
yes.
you've got to become vulnerable. You can't be the impenetrable parent at that point.
No, and, you know, it is a little bit of a risky move, because you're sort of seeding that, you know, natural alpha position, but you're building relationship,
yeah.
and... you know, I definitely make sure that I stay in the lead. But, you know, so let's pretend that you sit down and you do a reading section with your kid. Then you say, well, are there any vocabulary words that you didn't know, even if you got the question right? And most kids will say, you know, I didn't know these three or five, whatever. I guarantee you, if you go through that reading section, which I've done with both of my kids, and a highlighter and go, do you know this word? Do you know this word? Because the words are all over. They're in the reading passages. They're in the questions for the reading. It's not just the fill in the sentence part where the vocab comes up. It's all throughout. In fact, I'll point that out here, that the reading section is a vocabulary-based reasoning test, and you cannot underestimate the power of knowing more vocabulary. It's not only for those sentence completions, it's to understand, you have to very precisely understand the questions for the reading passages.
Mm-hmm. I want to hear more about this. Let's take a quick break. You are listening to the Art of Potential show on WCHL.
You're listening to the Art of Potential on 97.9 FM. WCHL.
Welcome back. This is the Art of Potential show with Kristen Heemstra, and I am talking with the wonderful Debbie Steer. So, Debbie, you were just telling us about the SAT essay portion and these esoteric questions that the SAT gives you. How do they grade esoteric answers?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you ask how they grade it. They have two graders, and each grader can grade it on 1 to 6, and there is a rubric of, you know, how they determine this on the College Board's website, as well as in the Blue Book. And I would say it's probably, well, no, it's definitely the least scientific part of the SAT, and most experts that I spoke with who, you know, whom I trust said, you know, the best you can shoot for is a 10. Hope for something higher than that, but the best you can shoot for is a 10. And then worry about the rest of the writing section, because you can get a perfect 800 in the writing section with a 10 on the essay as long as you don't make any mistakes on the grammar questions, which, you know, that's easier to control. I mean, much easier to control. So, and actually on some SATs, you can even do it with a 9 on your essay. So how do they grade it? So, you know, supposedly, holistically, it's supposed to be, you know, they do ask a somewhat thought-provoking esoteric and very thought-provoking prompt.
What would be a sample of a prompt?
Oh, goodness. You know, some version of, you know, is creativity good or is creativity bad? I mean, okay. They'll ask it in a very dressed up,
yes,
you know, with lots of trimmings way. They give this a little blurb that you can read to kind of get your juices going. And most experts said, don't read that, that it's just a waste of time. And so I didn't. And then they will ask you, you know, some version of some moral dilemma. Is it good to help other people in the world, or should we be thinking about ourselves and da 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 da? Or, and then every once in a while they'll throw in a curveball and they'll ask some version of, is technology good or bad? Which I always was terrified of, because it's hard to fit. You know, if you're going in with the, you know, Great Gatsby example, which is why you probably should remain a little flexible if you can about what you're going to write about. I couldn't think of what I was going to use for the technology prompt. Thankfully, I did not get that prompt. but I did get the reality TV prompt, which was, you know, is reality TV good or bad? And people were crazy angry about that prompt. They thought it was unfair if you hadn't watched reality television. And it was, you know, when I looked into it, much more like an ACT essay prompt. And I don't know if they've done that since then, but, you know, the point of the essay is it's a rhetoric essay. They want to see whether you can form a cohesive five paragraph, although it doesn't have to be five paragraphs, but a traditional essay where you're making an argument for one case or another.
Persuasive argument, okay.
Yes, that's what they want. They want to see you make an argument, a thoughtful argument with as few grammatical errors and as sophisticated vocabulary and punctuation as possible.
So can you be on the fence and say, well, yes, is
not
both
at all
good or bad?
I messed that up at the beginning. The first two, what you can do is this. You need to pick a side and be unequivocal, and you make your case. However, what academics do is they will talk about the other argument, but not in terms of, it could go this way, it could go. They're going to say, while some may say, and so in my last essay, I did that. I gave the counter argument and why I thought that was unreasonable. But you absolutely have to be unequivocal. Pick a side and stick.
Wow.
That was part of that. For the first two essays, I didn't know that. And so I was saying, you could look at it this way, or you could look at it that way. No. Because, by the way, you can, for all of these, obviously, look at it one way or the other. Nope. They want you to pick a side and stick. You can mention the other side, but only, you know, in regards to why it's a bad idea.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Well, and that honestly isn't really the way the world works, but that's okay. They're not looking at that. I'm just wondering why that would give you a better essay.
Well, it is the way academia works. You know, that is more like how you're going to write in college. You know, the academics, it's discourse. You know, they pick some topic and they might discuss it in a nuanced way, but and there might be a long lead up about somebody else's argument. Because, by the way, that is the reading passage is what they do also. It's sometimes hard to figure out at first where they're going, but what they want you to do when you're reading this passage is, what's the argument? What is this author trying to say? And often it will have a lot of another person's opinion in it until you get to the point of, but this writer disagrees with that. So I do think it is more of a college-like exercise in writing than a high school exercise.
Okay, that's good.
Unfortunately, most high schoolers in this country have not been taught to write like that.
No, they haven't.
But it is an academic, you know, college-level academic exercise in discourse, I think.
So you did all of this, reading, writing, arithmetic, took the SAT all these times, got your kids involved, and then you wrote a book.
Yes.
That's coming out in February.
Yes.
What are the main lessons you learned that we're going to find when we go buy your book?
Okay, so the book is, it's a weird hybrid. It's, I would say, half SAT advice, and that's in these pulled-out boxes, like you would see in a magazine article, the hard info's pulled out. And then there's the story of the journey with my son and my journey, you know, growing as a mother and what I learned. And so I think you learn both things from my book. You're going to learn, you know, different recipes for how to write an essay, you know, things that I found in other people's books. And I saw a lot of essays and just my own experience. You're going to find advice from, you know, the highest paid tutor in math, you know, experts talking about their writing tips and how to find a great tutor. But you're also going to find a lot of what I learned as a parent. And we touched on it a little bit before, but the warm level of engagement with, you know, teenagers who, you know, it's normal in our culture for teenagers. We're all encouraging them to separate. And I didn't go into this thinking, oh, well, the magic sauce is actually not to get them to separate, to keep them close. But that really did, you know, we all know teenagers. They come home from school, they go, so what did you do in school? And they go to the room, they shut the door, and they don't want to share anything. And here I was deeply entrenched in a very important and time-consuming part of my son's life.
Right.
And it allowed me to stay connected to him at a time when a lot of other kids were out doing things I'm glad he wasn't out doing. I had his eye. I, you know, was his North Star, and that is because it was completely inadvertent. Anyway, so you'll learn about how I developed as a mom and what I learned as a mom about connecting with your kid. In addition, and the power of that and the magic in that, in addition to all the SAT advice, and I really told everything I could think of that I learned in as concise a manner, you know, all the jargon, what's score choice, what's super scoring, what's test optional, how many times should I take it, when should I send my scores to, you know, how do I study for the math, how do I find a great tutor, what questions do I ask a tutor? So it's both. It's a hybrid.
And I love that. I love that about what you did, because you really came at it from the perspective of, if I were a parent, what do I need to know? Because to your point, there is so much jargon out there, and it is terribly confusing. And you address the questions that we get the most often. How often should I take the SAT? Now, I'd be curious to know, what did you say?
Oh, well, you know, I didn't necessarily come out with an answer.
Yeah.
I do think you should take it twice. I don't think you should take it less than once. And I've had people, you know, there are some students who got like 2250 on, you know, and should you take it again? Why not? I mean, the problem is, you know, some of these schools want to see all, and the messages that come from the colleges are even more confusing. They say, don't worry about it, but, you know, it couldn't hurt to take it again. It's like, well, which is it?
Right.
I think, why not take it a second time, even if you have to send all the scores? Some of the score, what is it, score choice, or I can never remember. Yeah, score choice is where you can decide which day, which test scores you send. You can't send, oh, the math from this day, the writing from this day. If you're going to send the scores, you send that whole day's scores.
Debbie, it has been a true pleasure talking with you, and we will all look for your book coming out in February. Do you have a website up?
I do, theperfectscoreproject.com, and write to me with questions because I love answering questions. I want it like a Dear Abby.
Yes.
I love answering the questions. I'll answer you with heart and soul, every one of them.
She will, and I will have a link to her website up on the Art of Potential's website. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for listening to the Art of Potential show with Kristen Heemstra. Please take a moment to follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook.